The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast, where we pick our favorite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me this week is a man who's just bought a yellow Skoda Fabia estate. It's James Baggett.
I knew that was coming. I absolutely knew that was coming. I've got a bone to pick with you, Jonathan Ray. I joined this morning's work call a little bit late, didn't I? And I joined to see you presenting to the class pictures of my beautiful yellow Skoda Fabia. And I can only imagine you were taking the mickey out of me, weren't you?
No. I actually think it's probably going to be a good buy. The 1.2-litre Fabia Estate manual in yellow. I actually think that probably is a very gosport car. I think there's a lot of people of a certain age that want a friendly-looking, you know, Fabia Estate.
Very friendly, that's for sure. Very friendly. Looks a little bit like a yellow submarine, if I'm honest.
Oh, it does, actually. Yeah.
But my theory with this, John, was very, very good service history, very low miles. Also looks a little bit different, quite unique. The Auto Trader metrics were pretty poor, but we know from the Seat Leon last week, which I did sell within 10 hours or so of it being advertised, that sometimes oddball cars that are a little bit different and have got low metrics do also sell. So I just thought I'd buy it as a little bit of an experiment. Could be a costly one.
Yeah, possibly. So give us an update. How's your week been?
It's good, thank you. I've bought a couple more cars. So I bought a Volkswagen Tiguan and that beautiful, stunning yellow Fabia. The Fiat 500 we bought last week has arrived this morning, which is very nice, in Bugatti Veyron Burgundy. A beautiful...
Slight stretch, but okay.
You should have seen our guest's face there. That's fantastic. And also, I'm waiting for a Nissan Duke to arrive tomorrow. So I'm hoping that turns up without any drama. And then I'll have a decent number of cars to advertise. So, yes, all good on that front, John. Thank you. But in between that, writing lots of stories. So lots to talk about today. How's your week been?
Yes, it's been fine. I've been not on the road, which has been very pleasant. But I think I'm going to move us on before we start talking about... inevitably the stories that we're going to cover this week. So I'm going to introduce our guest. Our guest this week is Jason Cranswick, Managing Director of Norton Way Motors and COO of its holding company, Marubeni Auto Investment. Jason, welcome.
Morning, John. Morning, James. Good to see you. I was having a little chuckle to myself as you were going through there, just trying to work out what level of intelligence was being applied to the cars you were buying. It's clearly artificial intelligence, isn't it?
So it sounds to me like you don't agree that the yellow Fabia is a good buy.
Well, let's judge that one in a few days, yeah?
That says it all, doesn't it? Oh, dear. Well, lovely to see you, Jason. I think the last time we caught up, you were at Cinch, which I'd like to just ask you a couple of questions about. Well, obviously, it's my job, but won't do that just yet. I mean, perhaps just tell us a little bit about how business is for you. And for those people who haven't heard about your business, about how it's set up.
Yeah, no problem at all. Well, look, I think it's fair to say that this year started better than the last year finished. I think we were all feeling the kind of the headwinds of, used car revaluations and that as we were coming back through, November, December. And I think also, to be candid, government announcements around, the shift to 2035, you could see a tangible impact there around consumer EV adoption. It'd be quite an interesting one to explore today, because I think the government and the media have got an interesting role to play there in informing consumers of what's good for them. Pleased to see that come back into this year and performance has uplifted. For sure, there's challenges around margin. So we're selling more but making less. I think that's a kind of an underlying trend that people would resonate with. It'd be interesting to see what we can do to sort of combat that. And our business is it's not unique, but it's I guess it's unusual. We've got about 40 rooftops across the UK now. We've got three trading businesses. So Norton Way, where I am today, this is in Hertfordshire and West London. So long-standing business that our shareholder bought in 2008. We've got RRG within our group as well, which is, as a very long-standing and well-known business up in the Northwest with 20 plus rooftops up there, representing some great brands. Most of our brands are from Asia, so Toyota, Honda, Kia, Nissan, and so on. And then last year we bought HPL, the used car supermarket business, which again is up in the Northwest, which is three locations covering, I don't know, it must be 12 acres or more if you join them all together, and selling 7,000 used cars a year up there. So we've got quite an interesting business model. We all sit under the umbrella of Marubeni Auto Investment, which is the holding company which I joined 2.5 years ago. And ultimately, our shareholder is Marubeni Corporation in Tokyo. So I guess we have an overseas investor who allows us to create a business portfolio here in the UK. It's a UK operated entity.
The HPL Motors acquisition was one I did want to ask you about. It was a big purchase, wasn't it, last year? It sort of kind of came out of, especially for us, out of nowhere, really. We didn't see that one coming.
Stock market, that's why.
Yeah, very clever. Just explain to me about why you decided that that was a good fit for the business and just how that's worked out.
Okay. You've led with the chin there. It is a good fit for our business because number one is geography. So, we've already got a strong presence up in the Northwest. So to grow further in a diversified business up there was right. Culturally, we really like what Jonathan had done with HPL, and we felt that there was great alliance between, that business and its culture and our core businesses. The big driving force behind this is getting some vertical integration. So, if you think about it, Norton Way and RRG are regional franchise dealer businesses. So, the benefit of bolting onto that stack, then a used car and a very, professionally and well-run used car business made sense that we can start to, recycle. So second life, third life vehicles can stay in. And also what it does, it gives us then that opportunity to have a wider spread of business as well and some economies of scale. So if you imagine now, the leverage that we have when we start negotiating with suppliers, when you're looking at, we've got total inventory now of probably 5,000 units as we sit today, and we can start to get that vertical integration, which I think for any big dealer group is important. We all look for economies of scale. If you're subscale, you get diseconomies of scale because you carry all the costs, but you can't disperse it. Or to have the right skill base, you've got to be able to spread it across multiple locations. And I think that's what we're managing to achieve now.
Can I ask you a little bit about your time at Cinch and whether you learned anything there that you're now deploying in your businesses?
I thought you were going to stop it. Did I learn anything there? I'm glad you carried on and said that I'm now going to do the book. Do you know what? I've got great thanks and affection for the time I spent at Cinch. I went there from Jardine, where I'd spent five and a half years working on that business and leading many different sort of initiatives around digital innovation and digital transformation. The opportunity to go and join Cinch at the time and get it in the air, as we call it, was fascinating and taught me a hell of a lot about e-commerce and actually how you need a very joined up stack of technology to be able to take customer through one continuous journey. It taught me a huge amount about customer propensity to buy at distance. And the fact that, it becomes a 24/7 business. We were selling cars at midnight. We were selling cars on Christmas Day. So, very low latency, whereas in a traditional business, you've got a lot of hours when you're closed and you still carry the fixed cost. Some of the things we've deployed, in our businesses since then is, much better inventory management. You'll know this yourself in your own ventures, using data to inform the decisions. Partnering well with people like Auto Trader for the market data, And also, some of the areas we've looked at is, for example, vehicle imagery. We've invested very heavily in turntable technology this last couple of years, which means when you look at my cars online, they look no different to and as good as the competitors' cars online. And that's the shop front, isn't it? And these are all the things that we were focusing on in the Cinch business. Also, behind the scenes, making sure we've got industrialized processes and that we've got the vertically integrated business that can see a car pass through all the different stages of its life cycle, which again, I think were great things that were coming out the Cinch model at the time.
What about your thoughts on online sales? Cinch is obviously purely an online sales business. I mean, I must say, $1 billion in revenue in their last year is actually very impressive. I mean, and although they are making still huge losses, now you're in a business that has got the advantage of lots of sites, some very big ones. How are you combining online and offline? The famous omni-channel way of selling cars.
I don't know if you can see it, the graphic that's behind me on my wall. This is kind of the vision for our business. And effectively, it's something that's a very well organized sort of smart city structure with an omni-channel route through it for the consumer. I think, and I'm going to sound like a scratch record of 4 or 5 years ago, I don't think we should be talking about online sales and offline sales. It's just sales, isn't it? The reality is, the consumer will choose at what point they want to come in and out. Selling cars online is not the work of the devil. By the same token, we'd really love customers to come and touch and see us and be part of our showroom business as well. But we've got to embrace the two. And a lot of the brands that we're working with are moving towards more quasi direct sales models in some areas that rely heavily on online promotion. But ultimately, robots don't buy cars, do they? Humans buy cars. So we've got to still be in a human touch business, and we've just got to embrace that. But we've got to have ways of working and workflows that are e-commerce like, because that's where you get the efficiency and the effectiveness.
Do you think one of the big mistakes the likes of Cinch and Cazoo have done it over these recent years is not setting up physical locations where they can offer what businesses like you can?
It's difficult to say it's a big mistake because some of them did, didn't they? Cazoo did. I think what we're seeing is the place that remains for the physical dealer. I think that's what has been proven out, and our strategy centers around having physical locations. But you've also then got to have the, very easy ways for consumers to engage with you in the way that they want to, which might be purely digital, or it might be a blend. And I think that's where it's a difficult one for a pure play online only retailer. You do miss that opportunity to have a physical event with the customer during the buying process, albeit every car gets physically handed over at the end, doesn't it? So yeah, I guess you're leaving a lot for that white glove handover on the driveway, and that's got to be incredibly powerful if that's the only touch point you have physically with the human.
You mentioned about people buying when you're at Cinch, people buying at all times of the day and Christmas Day, etc. How does that tie in with AI? I mean, it's obviously something that we're doing a lot of here at the moment. We're really trying to see how it works. And I know before we came on the podcast, you mentioned that it is something that you've been looking at or certainly get pitched a lot. What are your thoughts on it and how it fits into the used car or new car business?
Yeah, okay. There's definitely a place, point one. Point two is our current IT structure and kind of like, system architecture does not lend itself well for either e-commerce or artificial intelligence, because both of them rely on a very codified way of working, and most dealer businesses rely on very much manual, analog, hand-me-down knowledge ways of working. There's a lot of people pitching AI at the minute because it's the hot topic, and it's come from, left field a year ago to really current now. I think people are selling things as AI. They're really just rules engines or, robotic process automation or something. They're not really artificial intelligence yet. So be careful of people with bearing gifts, I guess is my view, at the moment. That said, there's a massive opportunity to put AI into lead nurturing, kind of through funnel activity. There's definitely a massive place for AI to work in terms of sort of assisted, chat and conversational commerce with consumers. And there's a huge huge place for AI to really boost the quality of things like vehicle descriptions and inventory management and so on. So there's a massive place for it. I'm really looking forward to the time when we definitely can embrace it into our business. I'm still looking for the proven point of entry for AI beyond the stuff we're doing already. And there's some good stuff that's been in our business for some time that's assisted by, you know, data and system-based decisioning.
Yeah, I think it's certainly going to elaborate on what it can do over the next few years. It will be really interesting to see how it is implemented into businesses. Just on a separate note, 2024 is really going to be a tough year for EV sales, isn't it? As we know, we'll come onto the story soon. The EV market is quite hard. How are you finding EV sales at the moment, and how do you see them panning out for 2024?
Yeah, I guess we sit in a bit of a distorted place, and distorted rather than dystopian. We sell a hell of a lot of EVs, but we have businesses in the south and in the London area in particular. The Norton Way business is very heavily geared towards fleet sales and corporate customer demands as well. And so, as you know, most vehicles going into that sector are electric of some description. So, one of my big challenges at the minute is finding, enough capacity to process all of the EVs we're selling into that line. Likewise, we sell a lot of used EVs to consumers because the price point coming down. So we're really keen on EV there. I guess the bit that's a bit lean at the moment is perhaps the Mr. and Mrs. Miggins walking into the showroom buying an EV, as their personal car. But hopefully, when you do kind of the news of the week, we can touch on the challenging article that came out this week in the Mail, where they were showing EV charging stations almost with tumbleweed blowing through them. Well, I'm surprised they didn't show a picture of a petrol station with pumps that are empty. Nobody worries about whether they're going to fill up with petrol, do they? So there's a big thing there. So I think, long answer to a short question. We're selling a lot of EV into corporate. We've got a lot of self-sac, which is quasi-retail, which is EV. Most of the brands that we represent have got a strong agenda of EV and are committed to hitting the thresholds. The bit that's just not there at the minute perhaps is, enough of Mr. and Mrs. Miggins walking in, buying one for themselves out of the showroom. But I think that would come with the level of tactical activity that's going on behind EV at the minute.
Interesting to say that you're having success with used EVs. It's a bit of a buzzword for us, John, isn't it, on the podcast? It's one that
I don't know
what
you're talking about.
It's one we often ask our guests, and it's nice to see someone who's actually having success with it. So can you just elaborate on that a little bit? Because there's a lot of people we talk to who are scared of buying used EVs, especially after those big price drops last year.
Yeah. Well, we all got burnt with it, didn't we, when we bought them and then they dropped. And we're very vulnerable to any pricing action from any manufacturer, usually starting with Tesla, and it comes downstream from there. If you look at it, I think about some of our businesses that might be selling. I'm here at one of our Honda businesses at the minute, and you can buy a Honda E now for sort of like £18,000. That's really quite affordable and quite a funky looking little car that's quite cool if you want a city car. If I think about, our used car supermarket, I went there the other day and, they've got a couple of Audi e-trons on the forecourt at, £34,995. Well, those would have been £55,000 a year ago. So, if you're buying and selling in the same period, it's all fine. The problem comes when you buy in period one and you sell in period two and someone's done a price realignment in the middle. That's where it's really painful. You've just got to know what you're doing. What you can't do is you would want to apply a huge amount of intelligence to what you buy in EV. I don't know yet whether your AI will promote an EV in its decision making because of things like retail ratings and so on.
Yeah.
But I can tell you the consumers that are buying them are loving them because they're getting a great car for a lot less money than it would have been before. The other big one is going to be secondary leasing on EVs.
If you talk to Auto Trader, they're always saying that the metrics for used EVs are very high. And actually, there are buyers out there at the prices they're being advertised at the moment. It's quite a brave decision, especially for a new business like ours, to dive in and put a lot of money in one, and the potential of that price fall then happening again. My last question, I'm sorry this has been a bit of a inquisition, but my last question for you is just, what are your hopes for the market in 2024? What do you think, how do you think this year is going to pan out for car dealers?
I think my hopes for the market this year is that we can start to see a recovery in margins, because we're selling a lot, but not generating the gross profits that we were. So we've got to try and see a recovery in margins. I'm hopeful that we can stay in sync between OEM, retailer and government when it comes to the messaging around shift to EV and ZEV mandate. Because, of course, ZEV mandate would determine the degree of tactical activity that the manufacturers have to put in. I'm hopeful that we can start to see some happiness come back into the job. Because I have to say, I don't think the automotive place was a particularly happy place over the back end of last year. And I think, you know, I'd like to think that everybody would start to get a bit motivated around some of the, you know, innovation and change and embrace some of the stuff that's coming down the line. You know, we're in a world that never stops changing, but some of the changes that have happened and happen seem to really annoy and upset people. And that's something we've got to get over, haven't we?
Yeah, some positivity for the rest of the year. I like to hear it. Yeah. Thank you, Jason. Right, John, let's do some stories, shall we?
Okay, so James and I are going to run through our favourite stories of the week. And at the end, Jason gets to decide who chose the best ones and who is the winner. I won last week, so I am going to start. And I'm going to start with Martin Lewis.
Oh, I had this.
Yeah.
Funnily enough.
So this is the story that Martin Lewis's car finance complaint tool, as we've labelled it, has received 262,500 inquiries in its opening, 48 hours almost, I think, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So a little bit of background. This is around something called discretionary commission arrangements, which is something that the FCA banned back in January 2021. So in effect, this is car finance payments, I'm sure everyone knows, with a bit of commission on top, but it was a little bit opaque to the consumer, I think was the point, wasn't it? It wasn't terribly obvious that as the consumer was paying for their car finance, the dealer or the broker or whoever was getting a little bit of a kickback for recommending this particular product. So the FCA, not a big fan of this particular thing, as I say, banned it in 2021. But now they have opened an investigation into these payments. And the general consensus is that with the FCA, there's no smoke without fire. And they would generally have, to launch an investigation into something, they've got to be pretty satisfied that there's evidence of, let's say, widespread issues with it. So they've opened the floodgates now, unfortunately, the FCA on this, because they've said they're looking at anything between January 2021, which is when it was banned, and as far back as 2007. And I think that is largely because you can't expect car finance companies, etc., to keep records of all these transactions before 2007. But that's an enormous date range to be looking at all these things. So off the back of that, that has now launched a sort of tidal wave of PPI-like inquiries. So I don't think this has quite reached the point where, you know, all these claims companies have come out of the woodwork and are starting to promote have you been missold car finance, etc. But that is surely to come. But at the minute, Martin Lewis has launched a little thing on his website, a form, and what it effectively does is you fill in all your details if you've ever had car finance between those dates, and it emails the lender to say, hello, thanks for my car finance. Could you tell me if it's had any discretionary commission arrangement on the top of it? And it's then up to the car finance company to respond to that. So it's sort of the beginning of a bit of a nightmare. This is how it looks. My question is, who, you know, we're not at the point of the FCA is still investigating. This is early days. And I mean, logistics have put a guide on their website, and as far as they're concerned, the FCA have not yet sorted out a redress scheme on this, i.e. the FCA haven't said, okay, here's how we've decided that this was a terrible thing, here's how all the consumers are going to get their money back. We're not at that stage yet, but we are at the stage of finance lenders being inundated purely from one, you know, form on one website at the minute. with requests going back as far as 2007. So it's a little bit worrying, this. I mean, my thing is, who's going to be liable?
Wow. So, I mean, everybody is saying it's the lenders, aren't they? Mm. I mean, logistics advice is that it's lenders. The Martin Lewis advice is to go to the lender with your complaint. It's certainly not go to car dealers, but it's the positioning of this from Martin Lewis. Things like the UK, calling it the UK's second biggest reclaim ever after PPI. I mean, that's huge, really, when those sorts of words are used. I mean, he said in this story that I think we've published today, that the numbers are off the charts, and in terms of the amount of people who've filled in these complaints on his website, 262,000 people. He said it's far bigger than the closing days of PPI deadline. This is a story that is going to run and run, in my opinion. I think it's going to be focused on the lenders, but if they've paid on that commission to dealers, I mean, I just suspect that they're going to want to get some of that money back in some way, shape or form. I don't know, but it is certainly a worry. Jason, what are your thoughts on this? And have you, you know, has the phone been ringing off the hook this week with customers saying, I've seen Martin Lewis, you know, what do we do about this?
No, I think the reality is no. Phone hasn't been ringing off the hook. Am I anticipating that there's a building up and a sort of bubbling up of consumer sentiment? Yeah, I am. I'm going to kind of pick my way through this one carefully, because I don't think anybody wants to step on the bear trap of making silly comments. But I think what this also talks to is, look. The FCA will do their investigation and they'll work out whether the frameworks were right. If we just step back from this, though, it's a big point that I feel passionate about, is the power of the media, because, you've used the name, many a time through your section there, of an individual that's created this. Got to be very careful, haven't you, I think, when you're a very public figure, of driving people in a certain direction. And making sure that people are taking a balanced view on the situation. It revs me off the clock, I have to say, because I think the downstream impact on people who make their living from selling goods and services, and someone has a view on and makes very overarching sort of suggestion on how, with what integrity that's been done. I think that's a big stake to make, isn't it? Especially when you have a business that makes money out of aggregating consumer data.
Yeah, I mean, this was rumbling before this week, wasn't it? I mean, we knew that this was happening. The FCA was quite open about it, and we'd written stories about it over the last few weeks. But it wasn't until, as you say, Martin Lewis is on ITV.
Very powerful individual.
Very. And then you just see that surge of interest, the public awareness of it really increases. And off the back of that, I think it's going to become an even bigger headache. But I mean, perhaps we should park that one over there, John.
But yes, watch this space.
We'll be right back. The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights. I'm going to pick what I think is the second biggest story of the week after your Martin Lewis one, because I had that on my list too. And this is the news that the House of Lords inquiry into electric car targets was published on Monday. And this was warning. Firstly, the report was entitled EV Strategy, Rapid Recharge Needed, which pretty much says it all, which is the idea of a good title. They're basically saying the government needs to take urgent action to encourage more consumers into electric vehicles. It came up with a number of recommendations and ideas. It suggested boosting used electric car sales with a battery health standard, so consumers know how much range is left in those vehicles. Importantly, they'd really like to see some financial incentives for retail consumers buying new and used electric vehicles. They'd like to see vehicle tax reformed so consumers know where they're going to stand in the future. That's still up in the air about whether it's going to be free of charge. And they'd also like to see the VAT rate for public charging changed to 5%. Now, I spoke to Baroness Parminter, the chair of the inquiry, in a separate interview following that report. And she really laboured the point of these financial incentives. She would like to see, I asked her, what do you think would help boost the uptake of EV sales? And she said she'd like to see these financial incentives put in place immediately, were her words. She said if there was a commitment to immediately consult on this necessary fiscal incentives for both new and used car, new cars and secondhand cars, that would be a win, she said. And I think she's right. I think I think new car incentives for electric vehicles were taken away a little bit too soon. That plug-in car grant disappearing, it was and proven to be a successful way of getting people to buy electric vehicles. And on the use front, there is nothing at the moment. One of the interesting things she mentioned, and the report mentioned, is that the Netherlands has got a very good incentive scheme for used vehicles, which works fantastically well. I think they can get €2,000 off a used EV, and that has worked fantastically. And the other one that was mentioned was the Scottish incentive scheme, which is one that I hadn't really paid much attention to. But this was a scheme where you could apply for an interest-free five-year loan on EVs costing under £30,000. More than 1,200 people took it up between 2021 and 2023. And that scheme was so successful, it had to be closed due to high demand. They'd actually handed out something like £26 million of these interest-free loans. I think closing it sort of defeats the object, doesn't it? But still, it shows you that actually, if you put some financial incentives in place, especially for used EVs, lo and behold, people go out and buy them. So some very, very interesting findings in this report. The other one that was we didn't cover greatly, but I saw that it was covered by a number of the national newspapers, was the absolute kicking that the media got from the report for their poor reporting of these electric vehicle problems. Things like the charging infrastructure and all these people having to queue up. And I think Rowan Atkinson, Mr. Bean, got a particular kicking in the Times. He was named actually in the report as being one of the biggest problems when it came to EV uptake. I think it's a little bit unfair on him, but yeah, very, very interesting report, long awaited, and it will be fascinating to see whether the government actually takes heed and does anything in the upcoming budget. I don't know, what do you think?
Interesting you mentioned the news articles, because that was the thing I picked up on, is that one of the things they reckon is that the consumers really need like a proper go-to source of comprehensive and clear and balanced information, is what they say. And that should be developed by the government alongside industry and consumer figures, probably Martin.
There was one though, wasn't there? Was it Go Ultra Low or something?
Yes. I suppose there was. That sort of disappeared slightly.
It disappeared, but I think.
Yeah. I can see that it's almost like there's a tidal wave of positive and negatives information coming out, and I can see why consumers are completely baffled by it. And you know, I can see why there's an incentive to write not so positive things about EVs, because it does get you some clicks. So that's what you're fighting against, isn't it? And
the argument,
not surprising that, as Jason says, Mr. and Mrs. Miggins, you know, thinks, shall I go and buy a Honda E, Google it, and then go, oh no, that seems like too much of a hassle.
I mean, not wanting to defend the national press, but I sort of will. I mean, they would say they're reflecting public opinion from Middle England, you know, especially Daily Mail and the Times. But
the problem with that is that public opinion is often not very accurate.
No. What do you think, Jason, on this run? I mean, a very
It's the thought of ending up on the sidebar of shame on the Daily Mail. I think there's a few things in this. I read the report as well, or the headlines from it, and I think there was some fairly sensible outcomes from or suggestions in that report. And I think that one of sort of education and good information, I think, are key. And I think that, you know, the general public still need to be well informed on EV ownership. It was interesting. I thought back, you know, a few years ago, I was the initial chair of the NFDA EV working group. So we spent quite a lot of time liaising with, you know, government, departments in terms of EV. This going back to sort of 2019. And what was clear is there was a high level of confusion in government. Global markets have all used government subsidies as good ways of incentivizing people to adopt EVs. So I'm amazed that we're still without as a country, because I think there's a lot could be done there. And I think, you know, just generally, you know, we've got to get accurate information in the hands of the consumers. And that's my biggest beef at the minute. Funny enough, I saw, you know, elements of the same article I mentioned to you before with, you know, in the Daily Mail, shameless to say, I was reading it online, and there was a whole thing in there about, you know, demonising, you know, how, you know, is EV now dead for the consumer, and showing, you know, pictures of EV charging stations, you know, with tumbleweed blowing through them. Well, you know, I sat there chuckling to myself because my EV was plugged into the wall at my house, so I was going to get 260 miles out of it the next day, so I wasn't even worried about where I was going to go fill it up with electric. And you know what? If I was in a petrol car, I really wouldn't be worried whether I pulled up a petrol station and was there going to be an empty pump there? Because of course there will be. So I think the media's got a big job to do to help steer consumers in the right direction and underpin the UK economy. That's what we're all about, isn't it? Consumer confidence underpins most of our industry. And that's where I'd ask the media to take an unbiased and balanced view rather than clickbait, as you kind of point out, John, in terms of your comment. My only other thought on that one is I did see that there was a mention of they're looking for a car czar, aren't they now? The government wants a car czar. Unfortunately, I've got two jobs already. I can't stand a third one, but I'm not quite sure how well I get on in government trying to influence their policy anyway.
I think car czar sounds like a new online startup for used car sales.
Yeah. So there is actually a business called car czar.
Is there?
So maybe they just need to look in Southwick, where they're
Google it.
Based. Oh dear! Right, I'll move.
Well, hopefully, Carzar will do well off the back of the clicks.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
Well, that's true. I was just gonna, just before we move on, I was just gonna ask you, Jason. You've got various different brands. Some of your brands are more heavily invested in EVs than others, should we say? But I mean, I can see a Mazda logo over your shoulder, and of course, you've got Honda as well. How do you think those two within your dealerships are you going to struggle with the 22%?
I mean, clearly there's going to be challenges, and I think that's something that the leadership teams in the brands are very much aware of. I'm quite encouraged by what I hear from the brands in terms of their plans, you know, and, you know, they all seem to have a view on how they're either going to hit the threshold or manage the threshold through, you know, I was going to say steal or borrow, but it's not steal or borrow, is it? You know, kind of the whole banking sort of thing. Yeah. I think we're seeing it already that some of them are having to push heavy tactically already. They've gone ugly early, you know, to make sure that they're getting the volumes. Thankfully, some of the brands we do represent, you know, Kia, I'd say, is a standout one. You know, such a strong EV lineup already. I think there'll be absolutely no issues whatsoever. You know, clearly Honda are pushing harder now with the MY1. But there are a few that are going to have to work pretty hard as the year goes on to make sure that they do hit the thresholds. The worry is, comes back to, you know, customer perception. You know, when government announced 2035 as being the new deadline, Mrs. Miggins said, that's fine, we can wait a bit longer. But of course, nobody said that the thresholds for the OEMs, which come down into the thresholds for the dealers, were not changing. So our job suddenly got even harder at a point where everybody thought it should have been easier.
I can imagine. Well, I'm gonna. Is it my go?
No, it's my go. I think.
Is it
yours? No, hang on. No.
Thank you, James.
Sorry.
Well, I'm gonna keep us on EVs. I'm sorry.
Referee.
Thanks, Jason.
Well, I'll just slide this into another EV story, which involves the ASA, which is one of our favourite.
Oh yes, I forgot this one.
Yeah, so there's been a decision by the ASA this week that electric cars cannot be described as zero emissions.
Why? Please explain this to me, because I have no idea how this decision has been made.
Well, so a bit about this story. This is it's reprimanded MG and BMW for claims made last August. It's taken a while to get through, apparently. So they both had a slap on the wrist because they ran ads. I think these were Google ads. Along the lines of, check out our zero emissions cars, download your brochure now, etc. And the ASA have said, well, actually, they're not zero emissions, are they? Because there's various amounts of CO2 went into the production of that MGZS. Therefore, the consumer's not being informed about the full zero emission capability of the car. So I think this all stems, you're supposed to say, and I think we had a chat about this internally, didn't we? And a lot of companies are saying zero emission at the tailpipe or at the exhaust pipe. That seems to be the new incredibly catchy phrase that you have to say about electric cars now. But I mean, this just is, and I would agree with Quentin Wilson here, who has commented on this, described it as bizarre and very unhelpful. I mean, it is, isn't it? Like, this is not helping the cause of getting people into EVs, as we've just said. So then go, oh, actually, you need to just... be really specific about this and explain every bit of CO2 that went into it, because we haven't actually, correct me if I'm wrong, but every petrol and diesel car that's been sold up to now hasn't had any information provided about the emissions that went into producing it. So why is this any different?
Oh, strange.
Frustrating. Mm. I don't know what you thought of this, Jason.
I don't know that I even want to get involved in the debate, to be honest. it's bonkers. But again, you know, it's all about making things easy, isn't it, for the consumers and us being transparent. But, you know, that just sounds like a whole layer of bureaucracy that's just gone mad.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd completely agree with that. I was absolutely baffled by that story. And I don't think, like Quinton Wilson says, it's going to be very helpful. Right, John, I will move us on. And I'm going to be moving us on to... trading standards news, and this is trading standards clamping down on car dealers using unfair, their words, admin fees. So this was an interview I did with some trading standards officers. It was particularly Kenrad Elworthy, the director of London Trading Standards, and he told us that they saw a pocket of car dealers in the capital start charging these admin fees just before the pandemic, and that those admin fees were being charged on cars around £1,000, £2,000, quite cheap end of the market. And when they were being taken back to the dealer because there was a problem with them and they wanted a refund, these dealers were saying, you can have your money back, but they were taking off £300-£500 administration fees, which they'd often stamped over the original invoice. And the trading standards department were obviously not happy about that. They saw this started off in this, as I say, this little pocket of the capital spread out across London, and it's actually over the years following that spread it further around the UK. And this was an advice piece really from trading standards about admin fees. They're not illegal per se, but the problem with them is when they are hidden and they don't get shown up front on invoices, and they only are discovered when consumers come back with a problem with their car and the dealer says, well, you can have your money back, but there is an admin fee that we need to take off. They told us they investigated 60 used car dealers in a project funded by National Trading Standards and found nearly a quarter were non-compliant. Some were even charging, they say, questionable fees for cleaning, which was another thing that they said they weren't very happy with. So they said they're aware there's still an issue out there in the motor trade with this, but the number of complaints has reduced since they took this action. But this story was really an additional warning to dealers that they need to think very carefully about how they present admin fees. It's more the fact that it's not a problem if they are on there at the start and are fully explained to the customer. It's a problem when they suddenly appear on the invoices afterwards. So yeah, and interesting to see trading standards once again clamping down on the motor trade for something that they probably shouldn't be doing, John.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting that the headline here has got some dealers were charging admin fees of up to 50% of the purchase price of the car. I'm assuming these are quite low priced cars.
Well, we're talking a £1,000 car and they were charging an admin fee of £500, which was only charged when they brought the car back.
Ah, I see. Right. Okay. Yeah, that would be a bit of a
sort of how it worked. They said, "Oh, yeah, you can have your car, you can have your money back, but unfortunately, there's an admin fee on having to bring it back into stock."
It's a lot of admin, isn't it? £500.
Yes.
Will you be doing that, James?
No, I certainly won't be doing that. But I do, you know, there are businesses out there that do still charge admin fees, and I think they're. I can't remember. It was I saw an advert for one dealer. I'm pretty sure it might be one of the big ones. But they were very upfront about the fact there was an admin fee included. So there are businesses out there still doing it.
I think I've seen it on sort of car supermarkets, but it's usually around the £99, £100 mark, which again is fair enough if it's listed on the website in advance. That's the whole point of this, isn't it? It's not anti-admin fee. It's just how you present it. And when you present it, you can't stick it on at the end. I mean, this reminds me of my student days of renting a student flat. And, you know, there's lots of legislation, isn't there, around deposits. So your deposit goes into a safety deposit scheme with some body or other in the government, whatever, that's set up. And you're supposed to be able to get that back because it's nice and locked away by someone else other than the estate agent or the person that you let it from. And then if you haven't damaged anything, you get that money back. The way around that was to do that, but then charge an admin fee as well. And the admin fee does not get refunded at the end. So you end up paying another £200 or whatever just for the letting agent to do some paperwork. It sort of reminds me a little bit of that. And I don't think, you know, this is a select group of car dealers doing this, isn't it? This is not a widespread problem. But it just had echoes of that to me. And there, you know, the thing is, if someone brings a car back to you, I know it's slightly dependent on how they bought it and when they bought it and so on, but there are mechanisms in place to reclaim things like mileage, aren't there? If someone brings you back a car that's got 1,000 more miles on it and they say it's got a problem, there are often ways and means of going, well, I'm going to adjust the amount we give you back because you've done 2,000 miles in it, mate. You know, it's now worth a bit less.
I've got no further comments on this one. I think it's probably a little bit unfair to press Jason on this, unless Jason has got an opinion on admin fees.
No, I mean, I think it's very easy to paint a very broad brush across the industry. I think you're right, John. This is a very small niche of particular operators, by the sounds of things, that chose to have that as their operating model. I think what I think I can speak for is pretty much every dealer like us. We're really clear on, you know, how you treat customers fairly. Our responsibilities around consumer duty, whether that's with or without finance agreements, and you know, how you're fair and reasonable, you know, in a case of dispute. So I would think most dealers, most large scale or franchise dealers or professional dealers listening to the podcast would have probably glazed over maybe, you know, 10 minutes back going, okay, I don't do that, I wouldn't do that. I think the word of warnings you shoot out there is, look, you know, sometimes these things that you hear of other people doing, don't do it. You know, don't get involved. You know, just treat customers fairly. Do the right thing. You know, would your mother understand? I think is probably the best caveat that I was you know, taught many years ago, is do things that you could easily explain to your mother.
Well, you should say that, because that is James's philosophy for his business, is cars that he would sell to his mum, which explains his yellow Skoda Fabia.
We buy the yellow Skoda when it goes to age.
She's currently in a blue Fabia, so it'll be quite a hard sale, I think.
Not for final wrap.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Right, John, I think that's your go now.
It is. I'm going to have a slight plug now. But it is a valid story as well, so don't switch off. So this is Car Dealer Live news and Google. So Google are going to be at our event next month, Car Dealer Live at the British Motor Museum in Gaydon. And they're going to be, they'll be taking their wraps off and explaining its new vehicle ads solution. So that doesn't sound very descriptive, but effectively this is, if you were to Google, I don't know, a pair of headphones, for example, you would get a list of products that would come up along the top of your screen to take you direct to Currys and Amazon and wherever else. This is a similar sort of thing for car sales. And I believe it's new and used, is it, James? It's not not one or the other.
Yep. No, it's all cars.
In effect, you Google BMW 320i, whatever, and you'll be presented with a list of nice shiny BMWs from various different dealers and so on. So this is sort of a big deal, because that is putting your advert really right in front and center of where consumers are going to be looking. Because let's face it, everyone Googles everything, don't they? You know, there are people in our company that Google to get to Google. So I can imagine that people search BMW 320i to get
to... It's not me, by the way. It's not me.
No, James, no. So anyway, Google's Mohammed Loam will be taking the wraps off this and explaining it to everyone, which is going to be very interesting. And I don't know when this is going to launch, but it's launched in the USA, hasn't it?
Yeah. It's already launched in the UK under a closed beta trial. So there are some dealers currently using it. It's going to be rolled out, I believe, in around April time. So this is going to be a kind of first look at that beta trial, how it's worked for those dealers, explain how the product works, how it's what it can offer, and just some interesting showcase of it from Google. I'm really excited about this one, because it's something that we've been talking about for some time, isn't it? We've talked, I think I must have written stories about this maybe 2 years ago, possibly even 3 years ago, when they were planning it for the US. It's been in the US for quite some time. Apparently it's worked very well over there, and now it's coming to the UK. So there'll be a lot of dealers very interested about how this is going to work, and I'm really looking forward to that one, definitely.
Yes, it'll also be giving us a bit of insight in general around Google and best practice and so on, which is always incredibly useful, because Google is a bit of a locked down company, it feels like sometimes, with, you know, like, if I don't know if anyone listening is up on SEO, but trying to find any information about how Google actually ranks things is a little bit like receiving a riddle. They don't like to give too much away, do they? So I think that's going to be... They don't like to give too much away online. I'm sure Mohammed at our event will be telling us all sorts of tricks, definitely. Yeah. Asterisk over that.
John, can I wedge one last one in, please?
Yes.
And it is breaking news.
Ooh.
And this is genuine breaking news. And I'm sorry, this is cheating a little bit, because this is a story that I was working on, which I haven't published yet, but the press release has dropped into my inbox right now. So I'm going to talk about it anyway. This is news from the FCA that gap insurers have agreed to suspend sales following FCA's investigation into concerns over fair value. So this is a story that we broke probably 10 days or so ago, saying that the FCA was effectively, I use the word effectively, unfortunately there, effectively banning the sales of gap insurance. They said, we're not banning the sales of gap insurance, but we are telling everybody we'd like them to pause sales. Same thing, FCA, but I won't argue with you. So this press release has just dropped in. It says the FCA has today announced that multiple insurance firms have agreed to pause the sales of gap insurance following a request from the FCA. The firms which have agreed to this action account for 80% of the market. The regulator is going to carry out a second tranche of engagement, it says, with the rest of the gap market, with the aim of improving the value of the product across all firms. These firms have agreed not to use new distributors of gap in the interim. So my story on this one is about the concerns from insurers that actually consumers are going to be left in quite a difficult position now, because gap insurance actually is a good product. I think the FCA's concerns are the commissions that are paid out for selling it and possibly the retail price of it. I don't think they are worried about how the product works, because as we all know, it covers that gap of a total write-off. And that is for consumers who write their car off a week after buying a brand new one in the showroom. Very, very helpful indeed. So the story that I'm going to be publishing shortly is about the fact that there are these insurance companies who are very concerned that the FCA are acting here in one way, but they're having a knock-on impact, which will inadvertently put these consumers in the short term in a very difficult position, because they can't buy this product. And over the next few months, while they're carrying out their investigation, there's a potential there consumers are going to be are going to miss out. But this is huge news for the industry. Gap insurance is a big part of F&I sales, as we know, at dealerships. And it's going to be a big hole to fill. And it's going to be, you know, it's another, unfortunately, another kick for car dealers, which wasn't really needed. Jason, what are your thoughts on that breaking news? I'm sure you've probably heard all about it, just as we have.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because we were expecting that as the outcome. So we stopped selling Gap a little while ago because we anticipated that would be the outcome. So we didn't want to be seen as to not trying to preempt and follow the line. I think to your point, James, you know, you've got to remember that Gap fundamentally is a good product. You know, there's many consumers that have benefited from it and would be delighted to have had it at that time. But of course, you know, what the regulator wants to look into is, I guess, the methods of payments and so on. So I'm not going to get involved in that. It was interesting, your point though, James, is for sure, you know, the revenue gap that will be left by not selling Gap may be fairly large. But that's something we just have to go and find other things to sell. That's not a reason for trying not to follow the line of what's right in the regulator's eyes. Yeah. So, you know, reluctantly, we stop selling it. We maybe sell other products that we've not been focused on. Yeah. But I'm not surprised that's what's happened. It'd be interesting to see what happens at the end of the total review, you know, whether actually Gap sales return, but on a very different payment structure. Because, say, fundamentally, you know, the product does perform for those that needed to call on it.
Yeah, I think the fact that the FCA reiterated several times on an angry phone call to me that they weren't banning it says to me that it will come back at some point. It's just the way it's currently being sold, the commission's currently being paid out, and the retail price of it, I think that's where they've got the concerns. But that's me guessing. We will see in 3 to 6 months. But sorry, John, that's a little bit against the rules, I know. But
no, that's absolutely fine. Because I was
too important.
Written that story and we're waiting for them to come back to you. So I was expecting that to appear on the website at some stage.
Yes.
But a very interesting story. I do think we've been, what's the word? Castigated, is that the right word? For saying effectively banned. Lots of websites have gone, some contrary to various trade publications publishing this, it has not been effectively banned. It has just been temporarily paused, says the FCA. Which is a phrase I'm going to use when I want my partner to not do something again. I will say, I'm not banning you from buying things in TK Maxx that are covered in like flocked material. Can we put on a temporary pause for an undisclosed amount of time? Would that be all right? You know, completely different. But I'll move on.
Dear. You could tell they're government watchdog personnel, can't you, when they're writing these things? Oh dear. Interesting stuff. Right, John, that's me out of stories, as you've stolen many of mine.
Okay. I'm surprised, James, that you haven't touched on Virtue Motors buying back 200,000 shares.
No.
As the car dealer remains a sitting duck for investors. I mean, I'm not the best person to talk about this, James, but
I've had nothing to do with this.
Oh, fair enough. Well, I can confirm that they have confirmed the purchase of more than 200,000 shares as part of the buyback scheme announced last year. So they valued these shares at 10p each, but it's paid significantly more to bring them back into company hands. So, I mean, Virtue is, just to get through this very quickly, Virtue, as we like to say, is probably one of the... It is a bit of a sitting duck, isn't it, for investors? So it'll be interesting to see what happens after this.
I'm surprised we haven't seen anybody come forward with an offer for Virtue just yet. And I'm sure it'll happen sooner or later. But then everybody's attention is currently on Inchcape, isn't it? So maybe that's the one that's on the market. So it's a lot easier to buy one that's definitely up for sale.
Okay. Are we reaching the end of our stories then?
Oh, well, I have. I'm out.
Okay. Well, Jason, before I ask your verdict, are there any stories you think we've missed? Ideally, not in the Mail Online.
There's a story that you've missed, which probably feeds into my view on which one of these stories you did pick that's going to win. But, you know, the impact that Taylor Swift's had on the NFL, you know, it amazed me You know, apparently you've got beauty products now being advertised at the halftime, you know, break on the NFL purely as a result of Taylor Swift, you know, and this very powerful media individual getting involved in a topic. So that is a message in there somewhere about the power of media individuals and how it informs consumer behavior.
Interesting. I see where you're going with that. I mean, I'm surprised James didn't pick up on that because he does have a Google alert for Taylor Swift. There we are.
Spotify favorite, of course.
You know what? You did get me thinking, though, when you said about people who Google to find Google. And I sat there, you see my brain working, thinking, do I do that?
I think more people do it than you might think.
Yeah.
Instinctively. So I'm going to have to ask you, who chose the best stories? What's your winning story of the week?
I think the strongest story, not necessarily the winning story, but I think the strongest story with the impact of the Martin Lewis consumer finance situation. That's going to be the strongest one. For the wrong reasons, that gets my vote.
Yes, you, John. Another win on the bounce.
That's what we like.
Well done.
Well, on that note, all that's left for me to say is thank you, Jason, for judging today. Been lovely to have you on, and we do hope you'll come back.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate the invite. Really, really appreciate it. Thanks to you both.
Yeah, nice to see you. Thank you.
It's been a delight. And thank you as well to James for letting us make fun of his latest purchase.
You're welcome.
And thank you for listening. If you are in the market for a yellow Skoda Fabia, do get in touch. We'll be back next week with another episode, so make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you want to check out the stories we mentioned today, take a look in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk. Also head to cardealerlive.co.uk to buy your ticket for our event next month before they sell out. Thanks for listening and goodbye.